proceed with the second case of the morning, which is Crew versus Aiken. We have Mr. Bishop.
May it please the court, I represent the only defendant in this case, Michael Aiken, who is a former chancellor of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he is here solely in his individual capacity. Before the district court entered a declaratory judgment order against Mr. Aiken, he had permanently retracted the policy at issue in this litigation. Furthermore, he had by then retired as chancellor of the university, and his successor as chancellor had informed the district court that she agreed with the retraction. And as a result, Judge Mim found that, quote, the policy from which plaintiffs sought relief no longer exists and cannot reasonably be expected to reoccur. Now, Judge Mim entered a declaratory judgment in favor of plaintiffs anyway, but it's our position that in these circumstances, equitable relief for any of the plaintiffs is improper. Plaintiffs' claims are about their past exposure to past conduct by a former official with no continuing present adverse effects, and that provides no basis for declaratory relief. Now, the two student plaintiffs, McKinn and Reese, were awarded only declaratory relief. They didn't seek damages, so they are out of court, and that leaves only five employees, four faculty members, and a graduate teaching assistant. And that's important, because a public employer has more leeway under the First Amendment to combat disruption of its mission by employees than it does by others. And how much leeway is determined by balancing the infringement on the employee speech rights against the interest that the public employer serves in carrying out its functions by preventing the harm that the speech can cause. And we believe that the district court here erred in the way that it conducted this balance between the students and the university's interests. But even if this court were to find that there were a First Amendment violation here, plaintiffs have not met their burden, it's their burden, to show that the balance was clearly established in favor of the students at the time that the chancellor made this decision in reasonably analogous case law. When Chancellor Aiken promulgated the policy, it was not unreasonable for him to strike the balance the way that he did, and so we believe he's entitled in the alternative to qualified immunity.
You're professing the Pickering balance, right?
Well, there's obviously a dispute not only between the. I don't think it matters ultimately, but there is a more stringent burden on an employer under NTEU. There's a considerable confusion in the case law. I mean, clearly some circuits have applied the NTEU test, which requires a greater showing of harm to the university and a tighter fit between the prior restraint and ending the harm. Some have applied that test whenever there is a prior restraint. The Second Circuit does that, for example. And this court's decision in Milwaukee Police at least points in that direction. But at the same time, and I think the better position is, that NTU and Pickering are really points on a sliding scale, and that what you look at is the scope of the employee speech interests that are restrained, and the greater the restraint, then the more the burden is on the employer. The greater the burden is to show harm to itself and a good fit. And that is the position that's been taken in a number of courts. I mean, this court in Messman was faced with a prior restraint. It was a restraint that prohibited firefighters from volunteering with neighboring other fire departments, and that volunteering had a political speech element to it, in that firefighters were volunteering with neighborhood fire departments to show support for these unincorporated areas remaining unincorporated, this court found. And despite the fact that there was prior restraint, this court applied the Pickering balance. Just a couple of months ago, in the Belcher case, the Tenth Circuit applied the Pickering balance rather than NTEU to a prior restraint, and it explained that the restraint in that case was narrow. it was a narrow segment of speech that was restrained, leaving the employees with considerable leeway to address audience in other matters. And it found that in those circumstances, Pickering rather than NTU applies. And I'd refer the court to the Weaver decision in the Second Circuit, which seems to me to explicitly adopt this idea that NTU and Pickering are really two points, the two ends of a sliding scale. Now, on that approach, we think that this case fits very firmly on the Pickering end of the scale rather than the NTU end of the scale. And at that end of the scale, greater deference is given to the decision-making of the public employer about what harm will befall to it if the speech occurs and what it needs to do about that.
If I understand this correctly, the email expressed concern that if these faculty members communicated with prospective recruits, it would be some violation of NCAA regulation.
That's one of
the justifications.
No, it's one of the justifications.
Well, isn't that the sole justification?
No, the email is at page 6 of the opening blue brief, and it certainly does refer to NCAA violations, but it also states immediately before the restriction, it is the responsibility of the coaches and administration in the Division of Intercollegiate Athletics to recruit the best student athletes to participate in varsity sports at the University of Illinois. And there are two justifications here, and they're closely intertwined. I'll give you that.
Well, sure. The purpose of it, as I read it, is that you're going to violate NCAA's contact regulations by writing these targeted letters to recruits.
That's one of them. But I would urge on you.
Did NCAA ever sanction anybody for, in effect, writing letters to discourage people? And that's what these letters look like. They're discouraging people.
Well, they are discouraging people.
How would that be an NCAA violation?
Well, we were informed, Vince Illy from our athletics department was informed when he inquired of the Big Ten and the NCAA that any contact is a potential violation. And the reason for that is that the NCAA rules have two purposes. One of the purposes is to ensure fairness among schools, a level playing field in approaching recruits. The other one is to essentially to prevent harassment of students. College athletics is, I'm sure you know, is big business. It's an important part, not only of public
and private. That's what you're talking about.
That is true, Judge Bauer. That is true. But there's a great deal of competition for the best high school and junior college athletes, and they are inundated with requests. And the NCAA and recruiting requests, the NCAA rules are designed both to ensure that U of I doesn't have an advantage over the University of Chicago Maroons in the recruiting process, but also that students who are maybe juniors or seniors in high school are not approached in ways, are approached in a way that is structured. And that is why both the identity of the people making the contact is restricted, the number of restrictions, the method by which the contact occurs, and the timing of that contact, all are regulated by NCAA rules. But I would like to go back, Judge Evans, to my prior point, that this is not just about the NCAA rules, because I think this is very important. The school has a very strong interest in ensuring that it has a good athletics program and that it recruits the best people for that program. The people who make that decision are the directors of the various athletic programs. This is a finely tuned process in which they identify the people they want to recruit, the people who will fill the positions that they need filled for the coming years. They have to comply with a 500-page set of NCAA rules in doing this. No public employer is required to stand by while its employees set out to interfere with and make these sort of contacts that are designed to interfere with their recruiting. And that would be true even if it were recruiting of academic students.
All of their speech, which seems to be unrestrained, going public, going on television, radio, speeches and all that sort of thing, publicizing this opposition to this mascot, or whatever they call him, seems to be unrestrained at the university. They seem to say in their own brief that this speech in this email flies well beyond the narrow category in which the university has an actual interest, and that is recruiting speech by athletic department agents. Your opponents seem to say there is legitimate speech that is called recruiting speech, and that you go, your memo goes beyond that.
No, recruiting is very broad. I mean,
that's the question.
And
how broad is recruiting speech? Are you referring to recruiting speech? Would you call that recruiting speech?
Well, this is a little complicated because you have, on the one hand, you have the NCAA rules. The NCAA rules include in recruiting speech any general correspondence about athletics. With a prospective athlete, although prospective athlete is broadly defined. Now, when Vince Ily sent out his clarifying email in response to requests, he narrowed the restriction to contacts with people who were prospective athletes at the university, people that we were actually recruiting, or contacts that addressed the subject of athletics. And if you, I'd refer you to page 66 of the supplemental appendix, which is one of the letters written by Stephen Kaufman, one of the professors. They're all the same. This one isn't on letterhead. A lot of them, the one on 64, is on University of Illinois letterhead. And it starts out, "I am a professor at the University of Illinois, and I understand that you may be considering coming to the University of Illinois as a student athlete." And he goes on later, "My colleagues and I want you to be aware that should you choose to come to the university and participate in its athletic program, you will be part of a program that perpetuates racial stereotyping and injustice. The University of Illinois may not be a good environment for student athletes such as yourself to further your education and athletic careers." This group made no secret that its intent was to dissuade these people from coming to the university.
And made no secret because they've preached it every other forum. And
that we have no problem with, Judge. No. That we have no problem with. We don't think
it, but there's nothing quiet about it. So I guess it comes back to the letter.
It's the manner and the means.
And to what extent, I guess, the athletic department can scrutinize it.
That's right, Judge. As this court said in Greer, it's the manner and means of the communication that can make a huge difference. We have no problem with the plaintiffs going on TV and on the radio and writing op-eds to the newspapers and demonstrating they do that all the time. And that's a healthy part of the university environment and a good learning experience for all the students involved. We are trying to recruit specific athletes to come to our university to further our program, a program that is very important to us financially, that's been recognized as such in the statute. Our membership in the NCAA is very important to us. We've had violations before. We don't want any more. We make these this recruiting is a carefully balanced game where we are competing with a lot of other universities. The last thing that we need is someone writing to someone who we want to come to our school and be a part of our athletics program, saying this is a racist institution, do not come here. And we that think that we are entitled, under the case law, under the balancing test, to restrict this sliver of speech, direct contact on the subject of athletics with potential athletic recruits, a small sliver of speech that leaves an enormous range of speech open that plaintiffs have freely made use of, and that our interest in recruiting outweighs the restriction on that narrow segment of speech. But even if I don't want to mention the qualified immunity issue, because even if the court were to think that we are wrong on this, and we certainly don't think we are, this court has made clear that in cases like Gregorich, that when you have a balancing test, it's obviously much more difficult for a state official to look at a balancing test and apply that and come out with a clear answer, yes, I'm entitled to do this, no, I'm not, than it is if there is some clear statement of law. And the court has said, this court has said in cases like Gregorich, that when you are applying a balancing test, there has to be, for qualified immunity to be lost, there has to have been, at the time the restriction was imposed, very closely analogous case law. That's the language in Gregorich, which clearly established that the policy was illegal. And we don't think the plaintiffs have ever done that. In fact, you know, we don't think the policy we don't think the policy is illegal. But it's certainly impossible to look at any case out there that is remotely like this and say, Chancellor Aiken, you should have known that from that case that this balance was wrong. In fact, to the contrary, there are cases like Messman and Weaver predated, I believe, predated. Messman certainly did predated the action of the Chancellor, that make it seem like a fairly relaxed Pickering balance will apply, where great deference will be given to the Chancellor's determination that the school will be harmed in such a way that warrants the prior restraint. If you look at the fact,
we never got to the point where, or did we? Did you? Where they actually submitted a letter
after the TRO? After the TRO was entered, the letters were sent, but we haven't been able to follow up and see.
No, but was there a circumstance where a letter was given to the athletics department, whoever it was over there, for pre-approval? What it's called, pre-approval for review, whatever they were going to do with
it. There were two requests. There were very few requests that were specific. There were two that were approved. One with a professor who wanted to talk to a student about a matter of academics. The other was an alum of the university who stated that he was anti-chief and who wanted to make a contact. And both of them were told that they could, one because it was not about the subject of athletics, and the other one because although it was about the subject of athletics, it was an alum, not an employee, and it wasn't someone who appeared to be covered by the NCAA rules.
He wasn't one of these booster club members or something, was he?
No, he was a regular alum. Yeah, the boosters are covered.
That would cloud it up a little.
No, booster members are not regular alums, is that right?
Boosters are covered by the NCAA rules.
I see. Okay. But regular alums are not?
Regular alums are not.
They didn't pay any dues.
They wouldn't work at Notre Dame, would it?
No. No, Your Honor.
The Fighting Irish.
If I can reserve the balance of my time.
Fine. Mr. Grossman?
Good morning. While you're at the Notre Dame, that last question, if Notre Dame faculty members had sent the letter out to prospective recruits, would they be still employed by Notre Dame?
Well, there's no state action at Notre Dame,
right.
So because the Constitution doesn't restrain university conduct, at least the federal Constitution does not.
I asked you if they would be still employed by Notre Dame.
He knows Notre Dame knows no law, but go ahead.
Well, I think the state Constitution might protect private university faculty. I think the problem here is that there simply is no carve-out under the Constitution for prospective student athletes. Under the NCAA rules, all communications of faculty members, if directed to a prospective student athlete intentionally, or if simply relating to, quote, any issue related to athletics, are treated as the university's official speech. That is the crux of the problem here. Because if they are subject to the NCAA rules, then they're subject to timing, frequency, and in most situations, absolute ban on their communication. There's no exception for the consideration for non-recruitment speech on a matter of public concern. And that's why Judge Mim continually told the university that the NCAA rules simply did not provide a license or an exception around the Constitution. You had to look at the Constitution, not the NCAA rules. Subjecting all faculty speech to that review automatically. You know, you did not have a chance to opt out of the review process. All communications with intended prospective student athletes were required to be reviewed. That was blatantly unconstitutional.
Now, when you say in your brief that this memo or email or whatever you want to refer to it, because I that's the other side. It applies to speech well beyond the narrow category in which the university has an actual interest, and that's recruiting speech by the athletic department agent. Are you saying there that there is recruiting speech by athletic department agents is something that can be at least, I don't want to use the word regulated, but can be used by the university as some kind of a restrictive thing?
The university certainly can restrict its agents for athletic interests to the requirements of the NCAA. What it cannot do is take people who do not represent the university's athletic interests and apply those restrictions without regard to the content of the speech. Mr. Bishop continually says to you that the NCAA rules have no content analysis. That's their problem, not their, that's the vice. That's not to be to be condoned under the Constitution, because it does not allow people to engage in speech on matters of public concern that do not impart a substantive advantage to the university. If you give me just a moment to explain how that works. When Aiken was first presented with this situation, he contacts the NCAA to find out, will contact by faculty members with prospective student athletes come under the rules, not necessarily violate the rules, but in the first instance, come under the rules? The answer to that question was yes. What Aiken chose not to ask, and he affirmatively states this in the record at D82, page 21, is that he believes he had no duty to ask whether any penalty would be imposed for that speech. He expressly states that on the record. If he had asked, what he would have found out is the very same thing that we found out when we took the NCAA's depositions weeks later. And what we found out from them is that they would not impose a penalty on the university, on a faculty member, or on the prospective student athlete, if the communication did not confer a substantive advantage. By the time we did that deposition, the NCAA was unequivocal about it.
What's a substantive advantage?
An advantage is something that would be determined to encourage, recruitment is defined under the rules, as soliciting someone to attend the university. Now, this speech, no matter how you characterize it, and I do maintain that motivation is an issue and would not have been resolved on summary judgment. That's simply motive, and we don't allow that to happen, and there was conflicting evidence. But I will give you certainly the fact that the benefit of the fact that this information may very well have dissuaded athletes or dissuaded a person. Any criticism of the university to anyone who's considering coming, whether it's a physics student or an athlete, would certainly dissuade. But that's not determinative of what the Constitution allows. The Constitution allows criticism of institutions. Mr. Bishop has referred to Pickering, and Pickering is the seminal case in which a teacher criticizes a school board, and he in fact engages in falsehoods, and it remains protected under the Constitution. But what did happen here, and what is critical, is that the university knew, could have known, and this is what must be measured in the formula for qualified immunity, could have known that no penalty would have ever been imposed. That wasn't a hard thing to find out, because the NCAA always evaluated this speech from the same perspective. It was speech by a faculty member. They were informed about Alinowicz. O'Neilly gives her information in the context of knowing what the speech is about. The rules apply. The rules, in fact, would have been violated. But what wouldn't have happened is no sanction would have been imposed. And I think what's critical to understand is this peripheral...
The rules would provide that they had violated the rules?
Absolutely. And Mr. Bishop is correct in footnote 6 of his brief that the communication with football players would have violated the rules, because nobody can correspond with a football agent except for an authorized person of the university, and those are the coaches, not faculty members. The letters that you see in the package violate the rule. What's missing from this formula...
Well, he wanted to suggest that once they said it would be a violation of the rules, that there would be a penalty. Does he have to ask what will happen next?
Excuse me?
I said, does he have to ask what would happen next once he determined that it would be a violation of the rule.
Who is that, Mr. Aiken?
Yeah.
Mr. Aiken never found out it would be a violation.
I know, but I said once they say yes, it would be followed in the purview, and by your statement, it would be a violation.
Yes, he would have.
Is he not entitled to assume that a violation of the rules would entail a violation?
No, he is not. No, he is not. And the reason that he's not is because he enunciated his policy repeatedly in the district court as being only imposition of the screening to see if rules would be violated in order to protect the university's interest from being sanctioned. And here's how he said it. This isn't a matter that's up for debate. At page 4 in his reply to plaintiff's summary judgment, he said the following. The application of the email, as it turns out, the kinds of contacts which the plaintiff did make after the TRO was entered, as evidenced by the letters produced to the NCAA during the deposition of Denise O'Malley, were covered by the NCAA rules, but the NCAA rules would either not have been violated by those letters, or no sanctions against the university were likely to be forthcoming because of them. Assuming, therefore, that if permission had been sought and permission would have been granted, this conclusion follows because the chancellor set the standards for the contact in his email. The email applied only to recruits of the university, and the purpose of the restriction was to make sure the university would not be sanctioned by the NCAA for the contact. Under the facts in this record, this is summary judgment, the contact plaintiffs would have made would not have resulted in sanctions, and the standards of the email for granting permission would have been fulfilled. I am quoting Aiken in the district court in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. And that's not a surprise. The reference that...
Well, he doesn't take refuge in the idea that there would not have been a penalty and he didn't know it. He thought there would be.
Take refuge? Well, here's the point. The point is that he could have found out there were not going to be penalties imposed at the same time that he found out that the rules...
I know that. My question originally was, once they say that, yes, it would be a violation, is he not entitled to assume that that would entail a penalty?
No.
If I went to the internal revenue and say, is this a violation of the internal revenue rules, and don't ask what the fine penalty might be, I couldn't preserve myself when they say, yes, it is a violation, and assume that there would be some consequences to the violation.
No, he could not. In fact, if you read Exhibit X, which we've been referring to, which is the letter from O'Malley, it's very clear, and that the NCAA testimony is to this effect, that if there is no substantive advantage granted, penalties aren't imposed. That's the clear thrust of all this. These people aren't laboring under some sort of mystique about how the NCAA operates. These were not serious rule infractions. These did not have to do with faculty recruit. This did not have to do with coaches going out and doing nefarious things. Mm-hmm. This did not have to do with boosters buying cars for people. This was
that's
a simple
substantive advantage where there's some benefit, offer money or something or other to this prospective student.
That's correct.
There can be a substantive disadvantage.
Absolutely.
So you can.
But disadvantages aren't covered by the rules.
Well, okay, that's the point. They can trash the school up on one side and down the other.
Absolutely.
And say it's racist, and it's not only that, but it's a crummy school, and they could they even be an advocate for another school?
Presumably they could, but the NCAA doesn't really care. There's a point in the reply brief at page 13 where the defendant suggests that it's only the correspondence that they wouldn't have sanctioned because they would have had a duty to know or to be unaware or else to have set up a regime. That's not true. At statement of fact number 122, we go through the rest of the correspondence from O'Malley, and she said, from the NCAA, this is an official response from their general counsel on when sanctions would be imposed, and she says that sanctions wouldn't be imposed if there was a phone call to a football player, if it exceeded the number of contacts that you could make, if it was out of time, because there's no advantage to this. And by the time we worked this through in the district court in the TRO, it was obvious to everybody. The last assertion, this assertion of a subsidiary interest in the interference with the interests of the university in recruiting, is pure subterfuge. That's never been asserted below. And to show you that it's subterfuge...
If the NCAA regulations were not even mentioned here, and it was just an email that would say, the official policy of the university is that faculty members may not communicate with prospective students, period, then what's the situation?
It's a blanket ban. It's clearly violative of the Constitution. First of all, what's missing here...
So if they use Judge Mannion's question here, if faculty members that wanted to just go and badmouth the university for any one of reasons, bad housing, bad food, no good contact with faculty members, don't come to our school, there isn't anything the university could do.
Absolutely not. And not only that, they could do they can engage in post-speech sanctions. Under Pickering, after the speech occurred, they can try to evaluate it and in a due process forum, but they can't inhibit the speech before it occurs. That's the essence of what's occurred here. And that's exactly what Judge Mim said. He said under some more narrow restraint, perhaps you could do something, but this is way too broad. And we say that in our brief, that Pickering might be a resolution of this problem for the university in certain contexts, but there are university professors all day long who tell students not to come to school. A person told me not to go to the University of Missouri Law School to go to Northwestern. He was on the faculty at the University of Missouri when I was an undergraduate. The law school's not as good. This law school has problems. This is the better place for you to go is Northwestern. People do that all the time.
I was going to ask where you went, but I thought I better let that one slip by.
I was going to ask you if you could dunk behind your head.
I would have saved money, but a university professor dissuaded me from going to the University of Missouri. So professors engage in that speech all the time. And they do it to physics students, and they do it to law school students. They do it to lots of students. There's nothing unusual. And also, you know, any criticism that you have of a university is going to dissuade anybody. So that doesn't mean that negative information doesn't come out in the marketplace of ideas. The university's resolution of this problem was to take some preemptive action. Keep talking up Chief Alinowit. Talk about the people who love it and talk about how it honors Native Americans in Illinois. Nobody prohibited them from doing that. The answer here was simply more speech. The other answer was to call these people in the first instance, when they read in the newspaper about this, and talk to them. Instead of gagging 44,000 people. This restraint didn't just apply to faculty members, it applied to staff and it applied to 33,000 students. And Crewe was a student. And as a consequence, and I want to stress to you that the defendants have not challenged the holding against students substantively, and they have not raised a qualified immunity issue on a student issue, and the only thing that they have said is she is not a student. And I would submit to you that a graduate student with teaching assignments, by the university's own language, talking about how intertwined that is with a student status, is simply far off the mark in suggesting that student has lost her rights as a student to engage in speech. But if I could return for just 1 minute to this ancillary interest, this interest that's described as interference with the mission of the university. That interest was not served by this regime. The proof of that is that they would have let the letter go out as long as no sanctions would have been imposed. So while they talk about that for the first time on appeal, they did not say this in the district court, as you can tell from what I just read you, while the interest is out there, that interest cannot be served by a regime in which, even if it violates the NCAA rules, but there's no sanction imposed, I let it go because it does the very damage that I've said it does. It interferes with the recruitment process. It's this letter that says terribly horrible racist things, according to the hyperbole of Aiken here today. But I've let it go. So that's the regime. The regime was set up to pre-screen and inhibit communication. Once I came to see the communication, and all of it was going to violate the NCAA rules, by the way. It couldn't help but violate the NCAA rules because the second that it's directed, it violates. Because the rules prohibit communication in numerous instances. There's a footnote that details 20 or 30 rules. So it's going to violate, but if it dissuades, it's not going to result in a penalty. So I'm going to let it go out. So what interest is served here? The only interest that's served is the interest of gagging employees and students. and hoping that they will not contact these people and will not engage in this direct communication. And that, by the way, is the major distinction between the cases that counsel cites here today. He has, for example, cited Belcher as a recent example of why this speech is to be allowed. But what Belcher said was that employees, fire department employees, couldn't speak privately. We're not talking about private communication. We're talking about direct communication. What they won't let us do is marshal all of these facts that are out there in the public and take it straight to the prospective student athlete, in this case by mail.
Well, how is that not private?
Well, we don't care if it's private or not private.
Well, you're making a distinction.
Because Belcher does not say you can't contact the council members directly. The firemen could talk to the council members at a council hearing. What they couldn't do is talk to the council member outside the hearing. But they could still talk directly. They could not speak privately to them. Now, what we want to do is...
We're back to Judge Mannion's question. Is it a letter of private communication?
It can be a private communication.
Well, when does it not become a private communication?
Because it can be shared with anybody.
Well, if you share it, then it is not a... I'll agree with that. But if most letters are not shared in the sense you're talking about, are they?
Well... It can be private, but the question here is direct versus non-direct.
Oh.
Because they say that we can contact them in a non-direct way. Well, you know, talking about all of the forums that happened at the University of Illinois in Champaign, and a couple of newspapers, and a couple of different kinds of, quite frankly, local communication, though there are exceptions in a few instances, they got wider distribution of their opinion, is not going to be heard by... The university has 20 NCAA teams with 500 athletes from over 7 countries involving over 30 states. Now, if you are talking about the recruits, even limiting their notion of this to intended prospective recruits, you would have been talking about thousands of people all over the world. And what we wanted to do, what our plaintiffs wanted to do, was simply directly communicate with those people and give them information that was in the public domain. And that should have been allowed. And in fact, if you look at it from the back side, it would have been allowed. All this did was prevent the plaintiffs from communicating with their prospective students, their intended audience, with a message on a matter of public concern that was non-recruitment speech and would not have resulted in a penalty to the university at a crucial time. It was in the midst of the recruitment season. And by the time that communication took place, as Judge Mims recognizes, there was substantial delay in what had occurred. And the communication lost some of its poignancy, and we lost the opportunity to communicate at the time that we wished with the people that we wanted to in a manner that the university said we ultimately could do. That harm, I suggest to you, was compensable. There was a metered response by Judge Mims to that, awarding $1,000 to each one of these individuals. And this behavior by Aiken was unconstitutional from the get-go. And good, competent processes at the administrative level could have easily determined that. And that's what Judge Mims said over and over and over again. He said it at the TRO hearing in the opinion. He said it at the summary judgment part of the case. And finally, he said it when he awarded damages. Thank you.
Hey, thanks. Bishop?
Here's Mr. Grossman's view of how this should work. He says in his brief a number of times that if, under the NCAA rules, the school had one contact left with an athletic recruit, it would be unconstitutional for the athletics department to give that contact, to keep that contact to itself rather than give it to the plaintiffs. That is the sort of disruption that we are talking about in this delicate process of recruiting the best athletes for our team. This is not a blanket ban. I do not recognize the email in what Mr. Grossman has said. It is a narrow restraint on direct speech about a particular topic that the university reasonably believes will interfere with its mission of recruiting the best athletes for the team and doing so in compliance with the NCAA rules. And the Belcher case far from being inept, looks to me to be on all fours with this case. It was a case where a direct phone call to city council members was what was prohibited, but all sorts of other avenues of communication about the topic and to the council members were permitted. I see my time is up.
Well, you have a minute, whatever you have, wrap it up.
And the Zook case from this court is a case where pre-publication review was permitted in order to ensure that police officers' name and title were not inappropriately used in advertising or endorsements.
Let me sneak one in. Is Mr. Grossman correct in his statement that Aiken knew that there would be no penalty involved?
I don't recollect if this is in the record. We asked and were told that the NCAA could not tell us that without more facts. Now, it is true that Exhibit X, which is what Mr. Grossman is talking about, does not say anything like that we would not be subject to penalties. This is the NCAA.
Directly, and so they didn't know that there would be no penalty.
That is simply incorrect. That is simply incorrect. That is not reflected in the record. Exhibit X.
Wait a minute. Didn't he just read from the deposition in which he said that?
The NCAA says this is Exhibit X.
No.
Can I read you?
No. Answer my question. Did Aiken say in his deposition that he knew there would be no penalty?
I don't recall that.
He answered an interrogatory.
I'm not aware of the specific interrogatory. I'm not aware of it. I believe that what happened was that Illy called and was told that the NCAA could not tell him whether there would be a penalty. Later during discovery, the NCAA said that they would escape penalty, this is Exhibit X, quote, only if unaware of the correspondence or acting reasonably to preclude it from being sent. But what I do want to say is it really doesn't matter whether they knew there was going to be a penalty or not. These were very specific rules that prohibited the contact. The university is not required to take the risk that it would be subjected to NCAA penalties. But more important than that, forget the NCAA rules and ask whether a university has to live with a situation where its employees are undermining one of its basic functions, which is recruiting the best people for its teams. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.